This show is brought to you by 13 Turns, a new horror anthology by Kevin Carr. 13 jolting tales of terror, murder, and the macabre. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio, and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. New movies today, I'm going to be talking about Star Trek Beyond, Ice Age Collision Course, Lights Out, Absolutely Fabulous the Movie, and Hunt for the Wilder People. I'll also talk about some news, the trailer park, box office predictions, and of course, the home cinema roundup. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com, or you can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
There's a handful of news stories I want to talk about today, but first I need to give a rest in peace to Gary Marshall, the director and famous television producer and creator. He was 81 years old. His last movie was Mother's Day, which actually came out earlier this year, and it wasn't very good. And you can tell that, you know, he wasn't at the top of his game with that movie. And he hasn't made a really great movie for a while, but it's sad to see him go because he had such a great sense of humor. And he was responsible for some of the most indelible sitcoms of our times. And you're talking like Happy Days and Laverne and Shirley and Mork and Mindy. I mean, these are things that I grew up with. So it's very sad to see Gary Marshall pass, even if he's kind of been out of the game for a while. The one piece of development news I found really interesting this week is Lionsgate came out right before Comic-Con and announced that the final Divergent movie is not going to end up in the theaters. It is going to go to TV. It will be a TV movie that will then serve as a launching pad for a TV series. Now, I know that the nature of television has changed quite a bit over the last, 15 years. That used to be just the sign of death back in the 70s and 80s. I'm not talking about like something like MASH, which was a motion picture that was developed into a television show and became a massive hit. I'm talking about a movie franchise. Like back in the 80s, if they had done the three Star Wars movies and ended in 1983 with Return of the Jedi and then said, we're going to take it to TV, it would not have been a good sign for that franchise. It would never have been a good step. And the only way that that's a good step is like when they do like a Saturday morning cartoon. Well, this is essentially where Divergent's going. And it's a direct result of the performance of the films. The first one made like 160 some million. The next one made slightly less than that, like 130 million. The third one made 60 some million. And this one, I don't think anyone cares about. This, mark my word, is the end of the teen dystopian future movies. It was also a remnant of the fact that they split that movie into two. That worked for Harry Potter, that worked for Twilight, kind of worked for Hunger Games, and then it's a complete failure for Divergent. So, which is good, because the last thing you need to do is split the last movie into two and then pad it out. The last piece of news I want to talk about is Leslie Jones got in a row in Twitter. People started throwing around insults and name-calling, and she quit Twitter. And it made a big news story because people were like, look at what happens to a woman who goes out on Twitter. A woman of color, even worse, if she goes out on Twitter. I ignored the news story when it came out just because I didn't care. I was like, oh, so what? Another celebrity has left Twitter. But I said, let me look into this now. And several days later, what had happened was Twitter had suspended this guy. His handle is @Nero. His first name's Milo. I can't pronounce his last name. But he's a well-known, sometimes very biting critic. His biggest issue has been Gamergate. That's his most notable one that he has gotten a lot of press for. I went through and I started to research it. I said, oh, I'm curious. What did he say? I couldn't find very many comments about what he actually said on Twitter. I always heard was, oh, it was racist and terrible and misogynistic. But I couldn't find the tweets because Twitter deleted his account. It suspended him. And first of all, two things. The last thing Twitter needs to do is try to be the police of what people say. Because it's Twitter. Anyone can say anything. If you spend your time saying, hey, we're going to suspend your account if you're spouting racial or any kind of, you know, misogynistic mean, even if you're just calling somebody fat like me, you're going to spend many, many man hours just deleting accounts, and people could just start up a new one. That's Twitter is nothing but a giant bulletin board. It's a giant message board from the 90s, and everyone can be mean, and anyone can get on anonymously, and anyone can send a tweet to somebody else. And look, I feel sorry for Leslie Jones, but here's the problem. When you're a public figure, it's possible you can become criticized, even if that criticism comes in a very immature and mean construct. And what I found interesting is when I finally was looking this stuff up, the only tweets I found from this guy, they were immature and mean and mean-spirited, and they were crass sometimes. But it was nothing that I hadn't seen on Twitter every freaking day I ever sign on. In fact, the real hate and the real venom and the real nasty language came in her response, not to him as much as people who followed him who then piled on her. If one person just tweets a handful of tweets and then it sort of inspires other people to tweet bad tweets, can you actually hold that person responsible for the actions of others? Do you read these stories and they're like, well, he dispatched his minions. It's like, well, you can only really judge somebody on what they do. I once got in a row with another critic who's kind of a nutcase, and he's a bit high strung. And he has a bunch of people following him. And what happened was when he'd reply, and sometimes people would retweet and favorite what he tweeted. And it was annoying because it just keeps showing up in your timeline. And it feels like you're being piled on by people when really you're not. That's just the way the system works. I just found a way to just filter that stuff out so I never heard it. And that's what you got to do if you're a public figure. You can't engage. So many people want to say, I just have to say this one thing. I have to defend myself. Trying to defend yourself on an open internet forum, whether it's Twitter or a bulletin board, is a futile effort. And all you do when you try to defend yourself is cause more problems. Say what you want to, be on your soapbox, that's great. But suddenly engaging with somebody and fighting that battle, that's a losing battle. And Leslie Jones should have known better. Not to mention the fact that a lot of her entire comedy shtick is all racially based anyways. You find stuff in her timeline that violates the terms of service just as much as this guy did. Now it's done for comedy. But again, where does Twitter draw the line? You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. First one I want to talk about is Rogue One. There was a Star Wars celebration this past week, and they dropped the Star Wars Rogue One sizzle reel, which isn't really a trailer, but I'm going to throw it in here. Opens on December 16th.
Pressure's so high. Like, we're making a film that's right touching my favorite movie of all time. But then if you're too respectful of it, that you dare not do anything new or different, take a risk, then what are you bringing to the table? That kid, when you were 4 years old, grew up with Star Wars figures. It's a bit like just being that kid again.
May the Force be with us.
The one line that Gareth Edwards says where he's like, well, you do something different and take risks. I just hope that these risks aren't terrible. And I just get the sense that this isn't going to have an authentic Star Wars feel to it. And that's fine as long as it's still a good movie and isn't bogged down in minutia. So I'm more nervous right now about Star Wars Rogue One than I ever have been. The next one I want to hit really quickly is the trailer for XXX, The Return of Xander Cage, which opens January 20th.
We need people with the skills and the attitude to take on threats we don't even know exist.
We need someone who can walk into a tornado and come out the other side like it was a gentle breeze.
I could definitely make that work.
Guns, girls, global domination. Xander Cage is back.
It's the next Vin Diesel franchise coming out in January, so that is not exactly meaning they've got a whole lot of hope behind the box office potential for this. I mean, January movies can do well, but I think they're road testing this to see if it's going to be like a Fast and Furious thing or if it's going to be a Riddick thing, which doesn't make a ton of money, but enough to just cover its budget. Anyways, it's kind of cool to see him back, getting almost 50 years old doing these things. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Ice Age Collision Course and Hunt for the Wilder People. Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies, hitting off the movie reviews. Let's start with the Ice Age movie. This is the fifth in the series. The last one was Ice Age Continental Drift, and that came out, I think, 4 years ago. So it's about time to do another one, because these movies make tons of money. Anyway, I'll talk about that in a second. Let's play the trailer and get going here. It's Ice Age Collision Course. The animals in the Ice Age realize that an asteroid is about to hit Earth, so they try to find a way to stop it, of course, without tools or modern technology or even opposable thumbs.
There she is, the mother of all asteroids, screaming towards us.
We're facing extinction, Buck.
No worries. This tablet holds the key. We go to that crash site, search for cosmic clues, and then figure out how to stop it.
Who's dumb enough to think they can stop an asteroid?
Crashing Eddie reporting for duty.
Duty.
Okay, let's do it.
These are the guys who are going to save the world.
We look so cool.
Like a ninja.
It no sucking was a strategy.
These Ice Age movies, as I've mentioned, make an insane amount of money. They are extremely popular overseas. They aren't exactly a huge moneymaker in the U.S. I mean, they make money. But starting with, I think, the third one, which was Dawn of the Dinosaurs, the Ice Age movies have been moderate successes in the United States. They've all made between $150 million and $200 million, which is okay, but it's not huge. I mean, to put it in perspective, the last one, Ice Age Continental Drift, made $161 million. It was the lowest grossing in the domestic. That's almost what Finding Dory made in its first week. Where their hits are international. The last two have made about $700 million overseas alone. They have made something like 75 to 80% of their full worldwide box office overseas. These are wildly popular all over the world. And there's a reason for that, I think. And this is not me marginalizing the movies. This is not me insulting the movies. I actually think that there's a reason these do well in an international market. And that's mainly because they're not dialogue driven movies. You know, I mean, like Finding Dory and even the Toy Story movies, those are very dialogue driven. That's critical to know what they're saying. In this movie, it's just a lot of slapstick. It's a lot of bright colors. It's a lot of very small action scenes. And if you only catch about half the dialogue, it's okay. This isn't Shakespeare. You don't have to get every nuance of it. And that works in an international market because it breaks a language barrier. If you can watch a movie without subtitles and get it, then that movie's going to do well overseas. That's one of the reasons why movies like the Transformers movies tend to do well. That's these big action movies. And where a movie like Terminator Genesis did well overseas, but still wasn't a huge hit because you really needed to know the dialogue. You needed to pay attention to follow what was going on. And when you're dealing with translations and subtitles and dubbing, that can sometimes be a challenge. Whereas the Ice Age movies just sort of bypass all that. Because they have such a huge cast of characters now. They add new characters in every episode. I mean, the first one was just this mammoth, this sloth, and this saber-toothed cat taking a baby across the wilderness. And now, like, the mammoth is married and got kids, and someone's courting him, and then there's a girlfriend for Diego, the saber-toothed cat, and they've got all these different characters that are involved with the sloth. So there's like 15 characters in these movies now. Now, with all that said, this is exactly what you'd expect from an Ice Age movie. It falls exactly in line with Continental Drift, which I didn't particularly like, but it was okay. I took my kids. They enjoyed it. I didn't hate the movie, but it certainly doesn't hold up well as a quality piece of animation. this is exactly the same way, you know. So you call this a negative review? Sure, I'm probably going to say it's overall a negative review, but nobody cares what I think. This is a movie that's made for kids, and not even Americans. It's made for the world, because Americans kind of only like these movies. The best part of this movie, as is there is with any Ice Age movie, is Scrat, the little saber-toothed squirrel who's always chasing the nut. Now, in this one, of course, you've seen the ads, you've seen the trailers, you've seen the posters. He ends up on a spaceship chasing this acorn around, literally around the spaceship and then literally around space, which is fine. I mean, I'm not expecting heavy science in this movie. They do have a weird little cameo by Neil deGrasse Tyson, which is funny because the last thing I saw him in was Batman versus Superman. So apparently this guy's making the rounds, and he can sit there and complain about how unrealistic certain movies are, but he'll take a paycheck and do a cameo. Good for him. So anyways, the Ice Age movies are fine for the family entertainment. I'm not a particular big fan. I think the best one was the first, and then the third one was the next. And then 2 and 4 are kind of about the same, and this one's about the same. It's stupid. It's dumb. It makes no sense. It's weirdly trying to make scientific sense, and I'm like, it's a mammoth trying to stop an asteroid. You can have suspension of disbelief for that. But in the end, take the kids. They'll probably enjoy it, and it's going to be a hit in France. I mean, it's already made like almost $150 million going into the weekend, and that's not even in America. But in the end, Ice Age Collision Course kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next movie I want to talk about is Hunt for the Wilder People. An orphan and his default caregiver end up stranded in the brush of New Zealand for months, only to discover they are wanted by the law.
Hector Faulkner and Richard Baker have been missing now for 6 weeks.
$10,000 to anyone who can capture them, dead or alive. Oh, alive. They should be alive.
So what do we do now?
We run.
Run, boy, run. Running is a victory.
Anna, maybe we don't need to run.
Oh, yeah. This is Fast Walk.
This is written and directed by the guy who did What We Do in the Shadows, which came out last year and was a great little sort of mockumentary vampire movie. And he has a real knack for kind of a bizarre take on things. And this is a very charming movie that doesn't appear to be charming at first. This kid, he's 13 years old. He's a bit of a punk. And his only living relative is that they can find is his aunt. And she lives out in the wilderness on a farm. And her husband is played by Sam Neill. Well, he bonds with the aunt, and the aunt's great, but then the aunt dies, and the kid tries to run away, and the uncle tries to find him, but then breaks his ankle, and that causes him to be stuck out there in the wilderness because they really can't get back. And they just kind of have to live off the land for a couple weeks while he heals. Well, of course, they find out that they can't find him, and they think he's kidnapped him, and they think he's some sort of pervert, and he's out doing crazy stuff. But the kid's enjoying this because he's actually engaged, and he has a good time because he actually has a purpose. And it's this weird little bonding movie where they want to continue to just live out in the middle of nowhere. But of course, the authorities are coming after them because they don't know the full story. But it's incredibly charming. It reminds me in a way of the movie Up, but without the house and the balloons and the crazy characters and sort of the fantastic elements. It's an It Can Happen kind of movie. But that one, of course, was a grumpy old man with a sort of wayward child who ends up in his care on this big adventure. And similar to Up, it has a very charming, warm heart. It's exceedingly clever and funny at times. It's got a real dry sense of humor. It's New Zealand, so it's not quite English, but it does share that very dry delivery of British humor. It's a very charming film, definitely worth seeing. If you like anything sort of different, this offers you something quite different. So I'm going to have to say Hunt for the Wilder People totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Star Trek Beyond and Lights Out. Take a seasonal trip to the zombie apocalypse. Kevin Carr's new novelettes, Not the End and Gobble, offer a new take on the zombie nightmare.
In Not the End, a man wakes up from a coma to find a viral outbreak has sent the world on the defensive. He must escape and learn the true nature of the zombies. The story Gobble takes the readers back to the beginning of the outbreak, which erupts at a tense Thanksgiving dinner. Not the End and Gobble by Kevin Carr are available now. Only 99 cents in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr here with Fat Guys at the Movies. I am going to be taking movie reviews to where no man has gone before, to the final frontier. Let's continue them with Star Trek Beyond. Captain Kirk leads the Enterprise on a rescue mission, only to be caught in an ambush and stranded on a planet with a madman.
Our captain will come for us. Mercy will be the last thing on his mind.
I am counting on it.
Fear of death is illogical.
Fear of death is what keeps us alive.
Everyone who goes there, he kills.
That's our friends out there. We can't just leave them behind.
Unity is not your strength. It's a weakness.
I think you're underestimating humanity.
I am very conflicted when it comes to this Star Trek movie. And I know if you've heard the show in the last couple months, you know that I've been very apprehensive about this movie. And it's better than I originally thought. But after actually seeing the movie, I realized only some of my concerns came true. This is exactly what you get when you hand the franchise that's always been known as a cerebral franchise, it's always been a thinking man's science fiction series, and you hand it over to the guy who directed the Fast and Furious movies and like G.I. Joe Retaliation. This is not a very smart movie. Let's talk about the good stuff. As a summer blockbuster, as a big sci-fi explosive action movie, it kind of works, you know? As just a spaceship with its crew getting stranded on this planet and have to figure out a way. It's not a poorly written film. And it's not that it doesn't work. It just doesn't work as a Star Trek movie. The problem that Hollywood has always had in adapting series, as recently as Ghostbusters, which didn't quite feel like a Ghostbusters movie, going all the way back to the original comic book movies where you had somebody step in and some director wanting to put their own spin on it, you end up with a movie that doesn't quite fit in with the source material. And if there's anything you can say about Star Trek as a franchise, there has been a very good attempt to keep everything consistent. Now, I know we're in a different timeline. This is the quote-unquote Kelvin timeline, which is branched off as a separate universe in the Star Trek multiverse, we'll say. But this just doesn't feel like a Star Trek movie. It's not a very smart film. The characters, the decisions that are made are not smart. They're like knee-jerk reactions. They're stuff where even in sitting there going in the audience thinking, you know, you need to approach this with a little more caution. But they just barrel in. And really, this has kind of been the way most of these movies have. If you look back at Star Trek Into Darkness, there was a very bombastic feel to that with Peter Weller as the bad guy with this big ship that's more powerful than everybody else's. Humph, humph, humph. It does feel like these movies are losing the essence of what Star Trek was, which is more of a thinking man's future. And you go back, even something like Star Trek V, which was the one that Shatner directed, and it's not a good movie, and it is resoundingly remembered as the worst Star Trek movie that has been made. Even then, that movie was a somewhat thinking man movie. It was poorly executed, but it dealt with classic Star Trek themes, which are things that are bigger than yourselves, things that are bigger than your own race, things that are bigger than your own planet. And this one is just kind of a prison escape movie. And even on that level, it works for just it being outside of the Star Trek universe. But as a Star Trek movie, it doesn't even work as like episodic. One of the biggest struggles that movies that have been adapted from TV shows have had is to not just give you another episode of the TV show. I remember when The Simpsons made their movie, the big thing was it needed to be something that was worth spending money for on a maybe once every 2 or 3 year basis rather than getting 20 episodes of it for free off the air. And I will say this, for most of the Star Trek movies, I really felt that the movie was bigger than just an episode. Even Star Trek, the motion picture, which is, has its problems and is bloated. Even Star Trek V, with the exception of maybe a couple of the Next Generation movies, like an Insurrection, they all felt like they were bigger than just an episode of television. And this felt like it was just an episode. It just gets loud. It seems to me that I watched this and I felt like Justin Lin had never seen a Star Trek episode. Or if he had, he approached it as saying, well, this is what I would do to fix these episodes. This is what I would do to make these episodes really awesome. And that's sort of the attitude I felt from this movie. Now, with that said, I mean, it works. It's a perfectly enjoyable, crowd-pleasing sci-fi adventure. It just isn't, it's not a Star Trek movie. There's no growth of the characters. No, there's no development to the characters. There's no sense of how they fit in the bigger picture. It just feels like an episode of a series that's not Star Trek. And that's my biggest problem with it. I mean, overall, it's a popcorn movie. It works. But not as a Star Trek movie. I'm still going to say, just for entertainment purposes and for the people out there, which is a lot of you, who haven't seen any of the old Star Trek series, any of the, what, like five or six series they've done, or any of the movies, it's still, it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk a little bit about Lights Out. This is a horror movie, and you know, it's kind of neat to see horror movies coming out in the summer, because that's normally not the time for horror movies. Horror movies tend to be, obviously October is a good time to release horror movies, but they tend to be stuff that they drop in August or January, because those are where the smaller box offices, that's where you can drop a $5 million horror movie, and if it makes $30 million in the theater, it's a success. So Lights Out, a family is terrorized by a ghost that only comes out in the dark.
Each one of us is being haunted by this thing.
A long time ago, I had a friend named Diana. And something really bad happened to her.
Everyone is afraid of the dark. And that's what she feeds on.
This is apparently based on a short film that the director had done and reminds me a little bit of Mama, about the feral girls and the sort of demonic monster that was in that. It's not the same story, but it has a lot of similar elements, with sort of this grown up female mother type figure having to come in and be the parent outside of this. And of course, this sort of creature that exists as somewhat of a protector, but also something demonic and evil. The script to Lights Out doesn't always work. There was a part where I'm about halfway through the movie and I thought, wait, hold on a second. With what happened in the beginning of the movie, how did that even get explained to normal people? There's stuff that shouldn't happen, that doesn't work, but if you just ignore that, if you kind of go in and try not to think too hard about the story, it's an effective little piece of scary filmmaking. And one of the things that's neat about it is, this is a great example. There's always an argument about PG-13 horror. People say a horror should be R-rated. I don't think a horror should be R-rated. Horror should be rated what it's rated. Horror should be made and then get the rating. And yeah, you're going to get a lot of R-rated content. Yeah, you're going to get a lot of NC-17 content, unrated stuff out there too. But you can make a very effective and scary movie that is not gory or overtly on-screen violent. Great example is The Invasion of the Body Snatchers from 1978. That's a chilling movie, and that was rated PG. Now, I might get an R rating if it were run through the process now, just because standards have changed a bit. Something Wicked This Way Comes was a Disney movie. It's a great little horror film, and I don't think it pulls its punches. This movie doesn't feel like it was edited down to a PG-13 rating. This movie doesn't feel like they cut corners to make it. It's just an eerie, creepy movie. And I think it works. And I applaud that. I think this is a great example of it being okay to have a PG-13 horror movie, because they all don't have to be violent and gory and disturbing and grisly. Now, with that said, it's kind of disposable. It's not as groundbreaking as The Conjuring or Insidious, which were, of course, in James Wan's wheelhouse. But it works, and it's nice to see horror movies in the summer that'll probably do decently. And it's nice to see something that's not just dumped into January or August. So, Lights Out kinda rocks.
It kinda rocks.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Absolutely Fabulous, the movie, darlings. The box office and the home cinema roundup. There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kaikman Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited.
Shirt, too sexy for my shirt, so sexy it hurts.
Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies, finishing up the movie reviews. Let's talk about Absolutely Fabulous, the movie, darling, sweetie. I don't do that very well, but there's a reason for that. If you watch the show Absolutely Fabulous, they always call each other darling and sweetie, in sort of that overly friendly, but very dismissive way. I just can't do it as a woman with a British accent. Anyways, let's talk about the movie. The train wreck fashionistas Adina and Patsy try to land Kate Moss as a client and end up on the run when the model washes away in the Thames.
Kate Moss is changing her PR. You've got to get her.
No.
Kate Moss, darling.
I'm here on the red carpet at London's biggest fashion event of the year.
Kate, Kate.
Police continue to search the Thames after fashion.
How bad can this be? I mean, you know.
You have killed Kate Moss.
I'm being trolled on Twitter. A woman told me I was a pariah.
Do you know what a pariah is?
Yeah. It's a fish.
In order to fully understand and get Absolutely Fabulous, the movie, you kind of have to have at least a little bit of history of the show. Now, I am not a fan of movies that people say, well, to really understand it, you have to see the show or read the book or read the comic book. That's the prelude to this. You can still get Absolutely Fabulous, the movie, if you know nothing about the show, because it's an outrageous, silly film. It helps you get who all the characters are and how they fit together and sort of what their histories are. They do a good job making it accessible to people if you've never seen even one frame of the show. But if you really want to get all the jokes, check out the show. The show's a funny show. I remember it was out in the early 90s. It was being exported from Britain. Comedy Central showed it a lot back in its early days, like when they were showing Mystery Science Theater and Kids in the Hall a lot. And I was in college at the time. My sister was a huge fan of Absolutely Fabulous. I really wasn't. I didn't quite get it back then. And even now, it's not like one of my favorite shows of all time. But it is very funny because essentially it's these two absolute just wrecks of people. They're Adina and Patsy, they're alcoholics, they're drug addicts. They have no redeeming value. They have no likability about them, but they're such a mess. It's sort of like watching slapstick. It's like watching a Hangover movie. Part of the thing with a Hangover movie is the characters are kind of deplorable characters. But watching them get into the insane scrapes that they do is kind of what makes it entertaining. And that's how Absolutely Fabulous works. Add to it the fact that it also takes a couple jabs at the fashion industry, which is an overblown, pretentious, stupid, narcissistic industry anyways. But the fact that they sort of take the screws to that industry while existing within that industry is kind of amazing. And I have a lot of respect for that because there's parts of the fashion industry like completely love being part of this. They have all these cameos of people I don't recognize, but they have all these cameos and it uses the fashion industry. But I'm like, you guys they're making fun of you. They're making fun of the ridiculous nature of fashion, the ridiculous nature of narcissism, and the ridiculous nature of having to be the in thing all the time. And that's sort of this way that Absolutely Fabulous works on two levels or multiple levels. It works as a fashion show, but it also works as somebody making fun of a fashion show. But also, it's just, it's outrageous. It is an outrageous movie. It is these two women on the run from the law because they think they've killed Kate Moss, getting into ridiculous scrapes while Dina's daughter, who's always this bit in the show, is the more responsible person, and she's got a daughter herself, and she's trying to raise her daughter in a good way, but of course there's the allure of the glamours of her irresponsible and mess of a grandmother. Sort of like Sex and the City, if you're a fan of the show, you're going to love this movie. What's funny is I know a lot of people that are fans. A lot of the people I know who are fans are gay men. I've got a couple gay friends, and they're just like incredibly excited about this movie. It seems to have a lot of appeal to a gay fan base. And they go overboard with some of these jokes, and they go crazy because they're so bawdy and so obnoxious and so crazy. This is the Golden Girls on ecstasy at a rave. That's the way Absolutely Fabulous is. And it works even more now that the actresses, Jennifer Saunders and Joanna Lumley, are much older than they were when they started this thing in the early 90s, that it really dovetails into that Golden Girls charm. It's way more obnoxious than the Golden Girls, but it's funny. And it is obnoxious and rude. But also, its tongue is firmly in its cheek. And that's actually what makes a movie good. So I'm going to say Absolutely Fabulous, the movie, rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office winners. Was I correct? Last week, I said Secret Life of Pets was going to make $60 million. I was going for the number that I had said last week. It was only at 50, just over 50, like close to 51. Ghostbusters came in with 46, which is respectable. It makes it not a hit and not a bomb. And it's exactly what I said it was going to be. I said it was going to be in the 40s. It was going to be along the lines of Independence Day or Tarzan. So it's going to tick along and it'll probably top off around 150 million or so, which depending on how well it does overseas, the fact it doesn't have China as a release market is a bad thing. But if it can go out and make enough money, it'll be a modest hit. Is it enough to launch a franchise? Well, as long as they don't lose their shirts, I think they're going to continue it. But I'll be really curious to see what sort of course corrections they make with the next movie. And if it continues the ire of fanboys who don't want them to remake Ghostbusters with a female cast. The Infiltrator came in very low. It was at $5 million. It came in at number 8. It beat BFG, but that's about it. Now this week, it's going to be Star Trek. Star Trek's probably going to win. Ice Age doesn't have the domestic burn that something like the Secret Life of Pets and Finding Dory and Zootopia. It's been a big year for animation. I don't think Ice Age is going to meet that. It's going to be more along the lines of Angry Birds as a release, but it'll still be profitable and all the money's going to be made across the ocean. I think Star Trek, though, is probably good for about $60 million. That's a safe bet. We'll just see how well it does, which is low. That's on the low end for Star Trek movies. The first one made like $80 million, and the next one made $70 million opening weekend, and that's a step down, and that's not good for the series, but we'll see how well it does with legs, and of course they're doing a new TV series as well, so that might help bolster it, but I think there might be some course corrections with Star Trek as well. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That's on means it's time to roll into the world-famous home cinema roundup. Before I get to the big release, I just want to mention a couple. One, you've got Bad Moon, which is a werewolf movie from Shout Factory. Worth checking out if you want to see sort of like cheesy, you know, a little bit lower budget horror movies. And then Elvis and Nixon, which stars Kevin Spacey as Nixon, Michael Shannon as Elvis, about their historic meeting. But the big one I want to talk about is Batman vs. Superman, Dawn of Justice, the Ultimate Edition. This is the 3-hour R-rated version of Batman vs. Superman, Dawn of Justice. The movie itself, it's not a better movie, but it's a richer movie. It gives a little bit more depth to the story, but I don't think they should have released this in the theater. A 3-hour Batman vs. Superman movie would have been a tough sell, even with the good things that were going for it. 3 hours is a tough sell for any movie. And what this does is it actually gives a little more story to Superman's side. If you watch the original movie, the theatrical cut, is very weighted on Batman's development. But this one gives Clark something to research and report on. It gives Lois something to actually do. She's kind of a damsel in distress, but she actually does more investigating in this one. Oddly enough, it was Batman who does all the investigating in the movie, is the theatrical cut, because he's the world's greatest detective. But Lois, you actually get her chasing a story, and that's kind of neat to see, because that all gets edited out in the theatrical release. It also fleshes out the story of why everyone was upset at Superman in the first place for going to this Middle Eastern country and saving Lois Lane, and what the aftermath was. There's little things in there. There's like a line that was taken out. But there's also a little bit more with Luthor. And I still do not like Jesse Eisenberg's portrayal of Lex Luthor. I still think it's terrible. But I understand it a little bit more. And I like where they were going with it. I just didn't like them mapping the standard stock Jesse Eisenberg frenetic Mark Zuckerberg character over it. I love the idea of Luthor going back to being this mad scientist, essentially. But they made him, Mark Zuckerberg, the mad scientist. That's what I didn't like. But that was the biggest problem I had with it. Now, the other thing is if you get the 3D version, the theatrical cut's only in 3D. I would have liked to have seen the R-rated version, the Ultimate Edition in 3D, but they didn't have that in 3D. And then there's some decent special features. There's a bunch of featurettes talking about Batman and Superman and Wonder Woman and what they're doing with the other movies, which is kind of cool because it really teases the next installments in the DC Cinematic Universe. So if you want to get that, that's all available on the Blu-ray as well. That is it for this week. I need to go. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Nerve, Jason Bourne, and Bad Moms. And I'll also probably talk all about the Comic-Con stuff that we missed this week. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.